Welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm Georgie Frost and with me is editor Simon Lambert. And we'll be discussing buying a home with a small deposit. Yes, it's possible, but should you? Simon proposes a controversial tax cut for buy-to-letters, which he said could help first-time buyers. We'll look at the intergenerational financial divide, what can be done about it, does it even really exist? And the year-long pay squeeze is over. But what next for interest rates after that dead certain hike that never arrived? Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, where safer savings set you free.
But first, Bung Millennials 10 grand cut tax for buy-to-letters. These are just some of the latest ideas doing the rounds to help people get on the property ladder. Will they work? Is all this meddling only exacerbating the housing problem in parts of the country? We'll be discussing some of these proposals in more detail shortly. But the big issue we hear facing those wanting to buy, currently renting, is finding the deposit. But with the increase in 95% mortgages and an increasing willingness of lenders to actually lend now, it can be done with under 10 grand. But just because you could do it, should you? What are the things you need to think about? Warm welcome. Simon, how on earth are you able to buy with under £10,000 deposit? Whenever we've spoken about this in the past, this has been the big stumbling block, hasn't it? We've spoken about figures of between 60 and 100,000 is the average that people put down for a deposit in London. Eye-watering figures, under 10 grand?
Yes. Seems astonishing, doesn't it, really? But it is possible. Obviously, it is not possible in every location, but it is possible to buy with a £10,000 deposit if you aim for somewhere where you may be able to buy a property for £200,000. And the key to buying a property for £200,000 with a £10,000 deposit is that you need to get yourself a 5% deposit mortgage or a 95% loan-to-value mortgage if you work it the other way around. Mm-hmm. And there are actually plenty of these around. There are slightly more of them around than there were a year ago.
How come?
Because lenders have become slightly more keen to lend, slightly less risk averse. They've got a little bit more money to hand out. And there are considerably more of them around than there were immediately after the financial crisis and the years following that. The big risk with small deposit mortgages is that house prices fall. And that means that the person who's taken out the mortgage takes the first hit. So you put 5% down, house prices fall 5%, all of a sudden you're down from having a 5% deposit to a nothing percent deposit.
Yeah.
And you've got a 100% mortgage. House prices fall more than 5%. And bear in mind that whilst the house price indices might only show relatively minor falls, what actually happens in local property markets means that what you could sell your property for or the valuation you could get on it can swing around by a lot more than the number you see on the Halifax Nationwide ONS House Price Index. All your favourite numbers there, Georgie.
Yeah. Oh, I love them. I absolutely love them.
But that's the risk to lenders. And also, after the financial crisis, they dramatically hacked back on anything that they saw that was risky.
Do you think they went too far?
Yes, yeah. And it also became more expensive for them to lend with small deposits. So rules were put in place that meant it was cheaper for them to offer mortgages to people with big deposits. Now, as confidence has come back into the system, as money has become more freely available, whether that comes from their ability to borrow on the money markets, to get money from savers, or simply a lot of the cheap money that's been thrown at them by things like funding for lending and the term lending scheme by the Bank of England, that has given them a renewed bout of confidence. And of course, the other thing that's given them a renewed bout of confidence is that the property market's been doing okay. House prices have generally been rising. They're suffering in London and the South East at the moment, but only because they've risen so much since the financial crisis. In most of the rest of the country, the housing market doesn't look too unhealthy, so a mortgage lender with plenty of money to lend out and a reasonably strong balance sheet and some demand out there from people who might want to buy a property to live in is thinking, okay, I might offer people this 95% mortgage.
Where do the government schemes, the Help to Buys and all that sort of fit into this mosaic.
Yeah, so it's interesting, isn't it, when you talk about the property market, because you also have to talk about the meddling.
Yes. Oh, we'll get into that in more detail. But just specifically with
that. But you can't set
that.
The scene without sort of talking about some of the meddling
yes.
that's gone on. So first important piece of meddling. After the financial crisis, emergency interest rates, 0.5%, and then they've stayed there, potentially at a time when we could have got away with raising interest rates up a bit more. Bank of England's very worried about the amount of debt. It's worried about killing off the recovery. This has made money cheap. And eventually, after a bit more meddling of quantitative easing, funding for lending, term funding scheme, giving money to banks and building societies, saying, lend this out, lend this out, lend this out. That has brought down the cost of mortgages. So mortgage rates are very low. Next bit of meddling, Help to Buy, which mm-hmm. came in two flavours of meddling. The first flavour of meddling came in giving people interest-free five-year loans to help them buy new build properties. So someone puts down a 5% deposit, they can borrow up to 20% interest-free from the government to then fund the rest of their deposit, and that gets them a 25% deposit on the property, which gets them a better mortgage rate, gets them to buy the new build. Now, at the end of the 5 years, they do need to start paying some interest on that five-year loan. The second, and that's still around, the second bit of Help to Buy was the one that tried to encourage more small deposit lending, which helped underwrite the loans for mortgage lenders. So it limited the money that they would lose if someone defaulted on their loan. They didn't pay it back. House prices fell. The mortgage lender didn't get back the amount of the mortgage. And that was Help to Buy Part 2, which offered this guarantee on an element of 95% mortgages. And that encouraged more banks and building sizes to offer them. But actually, to be honest, that was always considered a little bit of a mistake, because those 95% mortgages were coming back already, and probably the banks and building societies left to their own devices would have continued to bring them through. But all of that means that on today's basis, if you are a first-time buyer and you want to buy a property, in theory, you could go out and buy one with £10,000. Now, whether that makes it a good idea or not
right.
is another question.
Which I'm getting onto, because I imagine that these are much more expensive. Maybe not much more, but they will be more expensive. And then you have to figure out whether you're going to go 2 year or 5 year. And don't even get us started on the interest rates. That's coming in a while. So my first instinct, and I imagine a lot of people's first instinct when they're thinking about, you know, should I, if I have some money and I can buy a house, why would I throw it down the toilet renting? However, get the calculators out. There are lots of things to think about. And like I said, is it more expensive? So tell us, what are the sort of things that you should really be thinking about if you do have a smaller deposit?
Well, I guess the point that most people will start from is in terms of what are the comparative monthly costs. So I ran some numbers for this article that I wrote, and I picked buying a property for £200,000 with a £190,000 mortgage. Actually, that's relatively close to what the typical first-time buyer pays, according to the Office of National Statistics, which is £190,000. Mm-hmm. There's a caveat to that figure, in that that is higher than the same figure that the Council of Mortgage Lenders gives, which is maybe like £20,000 lower or something. And if we live in a country with a massively fragmented property market, you know, a £190,000 property will be a fairly, you know, fairly spacious three-bedroom house in some parts of the country. It won't buy you a studio flat in others. So you've got to pick a number. I picked 200 because it's close to that typical first-time buyer number. And also, it has the benefit of being a nice, round number that's easy to deal with.
I like
and
that.
And if you think back to the maths that you learnt at school, when they're explaining concepts to you, they choose the nice, round numbers that are easy to deal with.
So what did you discover?
Your £200,000 house and your £190,000 mortgage. Your monthly payments on that mortgage, if you were to choose the best of the two-year fixed rate options, would be £820. Now, that is broadly similar, I would suggest, to what it would cost you to rent that property, a property of that value. And I did a little bit of checking up on this. Obviously, mm-hmm. I didn't just decide to
throw
make
this
it up.
Together.
Yeah, we don't just completely make things up at This Is Money. I did get myself on Rightmove in a variety of towns and cities around the country and compare some So some kinds of properties you could buy for 200, some kinds of properties that you could rent for about 800, and these roughly fitted mm-hmm. into the same bracket. So like you said, people are thinking, why am I throwing money away on rent when yeah. I could be buying a house? Now, it's not a completely direct comparison, because are you throwing money away on rent, or are you saving on the costs of running a house? Because it costs more than your monthly mortgage payment. But this is how people think.
I want to ask you about this, because I am in this bracket, right? This is a personal question that I'm asking you here, Simon, my personal advisor here. You are a homeowner, I'm a renter. You know, I would be able to have a small deposit. Is it worth me? And there are times I think I'm throwing money away. So you tell me, apart from the fact I like where I live and I think I can live somewhere better because I'm renting than if I was to buy, because of course I live in London, you tell me what are the benefits. As a homeowner, as someone who knows the property market, reassure me I'm not throwing money away is what I'm trying to say to you, Simon.
So the benefit, and I had this conversation with Rachel Rickard-Strauss, our personal finance editor.
Who's recently bought, hasn't she?
Yeah, and we had this conversation when I wrote this article, and she was saying, well, it's not really a direct comparison. You know, are you throwing the money away on rent? You could be, you know, saving or investing the extra bit of money. And I said, well, if you're looking at the direct comparison, you know, that thanks to low mortgage rates, and this is the absolute key to this, is low mortgage rates mean that the cost of paying that mortgage and the cost of renting are pretty much directly comparable. The advantage of paying that mortgage is that if you are on a repayment mortgage, you are slowly buying that property. Mm-hmm. You are effectively making an investment. You shouldn't think of your own home as an investment, but it is kind of an investment. It's an investment where someone will lend you a very large sum of money to buy an asset that is, over the long term, highly likely to hold its value or increase in value, and will charge you a very, very low rate of interest in order to do that. There aren't very many other things like that that you can do. And the advantage is that, yes, you pay your £820 in rent, and then you don't have to worry about anything else. Your landlord looks after all the costs. If the boiler packs up, if you need a new washing machine, all those other things, in theory, although there was some research out this week that said tenants are actually dipping into their own pockets to pay for stuff their landlords aren't fixing. But on the other hand, with the mortgage, you are slowly buying that property. Now, if you start at only a 5% deposit, and you buy over the mortgage term of 30 years that most people start out on now, you are only very slowly buying that property. But also, and I will explain a bit more about this in a minute, over those, if house prices stay exactly the same, over the first 2 years of that 2 year fix, you would get yourself from roughly a 5% amount of equity in the property to just under 10%. Mm-hmm. So you can see how you're starting to eat into that, and you're starting to own more of the property. The bank is starting to own less. Unfortunately, you're still in the position where the bank owns the lion's share of the property, but you're working your way through it. Now, in your situation, obviously, like you said, you're saying, well, tell me I'm not throwing money away. But you said it's not necessarily directly comparable. You reckon you can get a better place for the rent because you live, you know, in London in the southeast. And also, you'd have to raise a much bigger deposit mm-hmm. to buy that typical property. But it's just a case of the numbers. So 2 year fix, it costs you £820 a month on the mortgage. 5 year fix, which is generally a more sensible option for a lot of people because they've got longer term security on their mortgage payments. That's very important. They're not going to suddenly have to remortgage 2 years down the line. They're slightly less exposed, therefore, to the problem of house prices falling in the short term. That would be £900 a month. So you're paying an extra £80 a month for that element of security. And we'll go into the 2 versus 5 year thing in a minute, I guess.
Well, we can do it now, Simon. Well, yeah. Would you go for 2? The wisdom at the moment appears to be on the side of 5. And certainly, as goodness me, as someone who rents as well, time just flies, doesn't it? As soon as you're in, boom, that 2 years is up.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've been living in my flat now for 7 years, and there's still a whole load of stuff that we were meant to do when we moved in that we haven't done. And I've been questioning, where has that 7 years gone?
Yeah.
2 years goes very quickly. I mean, we've had this conversation many times in the office with people who've taken 2 year fixes and said, God, I've got to remortgage again. It only seems like yesterday I finally sorted this out.
And most Simon, we've been doing this podcast for 4 years.
Exactly.
Wow.
And most people find mortgaging
Yeah.
A stressful and demanding experience. There's a lot more questions that get asked of you now, especially if you're switching lenders. You've got to think about it. And things change. Interest rates are likely to be higher than they are now in 2 years' time. So mortgage rates are likely to be more expensive. You're probably, if you go for one of the best low-rate deals, going to have to pay a fee. So you've got to take into account that you've got to pay one set of fees at the start for a two-year fix, another set of fees in 2 years' time, and then another set of fees on 4 years, whereas with the five-year fix, you just pay one fee and that covers the 5 years. But there's more flexibility with the two-year fix.
Mm-hmm.
If you do decide that you're going to move, then you can move and you're not going to face early repayment charges. Now, the only thing I'd say to that is that most people heavily underestimate how long they're going to live in a property. So, for example, you just commented how quickly 2 years passes. So most people think, oh, yeah, I'll probably live there for about two or three years. And actually, they live there for 5 or 6. Having said that, I've paid my way out of the last year of a 5-year fixed rate mortgage in the past. And it was a painful experience handing over, you know, well over £1,000 to the bank. But it happens. My temptation would be to go for the 5-year fix. A lot of people in this 5% deposit position go for the 2-year fix on the basis that if house prices stay the same, they'll get themselves down to almost a 10% deposit anyway. If house prices go up a little bit, then they'll definitely make that 10% deposit level. They might even make 15%, and that brings down their mortgage payments. The issue is that if house prices go against you and fall, you might find yourself in 2 years' time with less equity or in negative equity. Then you might struggle to remortgage, and then you might end up on your lender's standard variable rate, which are very expensive, and you'll suddenly see your mortgage payments go up. So I would say find a good independent mortgage broker, and if they tell you you should take a two-year fix, ask them all these questions about the things that we've just talked about, and make sure that they're not just recommending you take a two-year fix so that they can get some more money in 2 years' time when they help you sort out a new mortgage.
I was laughing there because I was about to say in sum, Simon, and then you sort of said it, get yourself a mortgage broker. Is that a good idea to speak to someone if you are in that situation?
Yeah, I think it is.
You're not sure you're renting. I mean, is it expensive?
Look, most mortgages, all mortgages pretty much have to be sold on what's known as an advised basis now. So they have to be sold with financial advice, mortgage-specific financial advice, but they have to be sold with financial advice. So even if you go direct to the bank, they're going to put you through to one of their advisors. All they're going to be able to do is just offer you that bank's products or that building society's products. So you might as well go find yourself a decent independent mortgage broker. Ask around. Friends and family might know one. Or we've got a partner, London & Country, and the reason why they are a mortgage broker partner is because they are good. And we trust them, and we know that they look after people. So you could try speaking to them. They're fee-free. Sound them out. There's no obligation to actually take out the mortgage. But, I mean, the interesting thing about the advice on the small deposit mortgages is that if you were to speak to friends and family, then the thing that you are likely to encounter is the suggestion that small deposit mortgages are dangerous, they were what caused the financial crisis, and that they should probably be banned.
But?
Well, look, there's an interesting thing that actually shows that this is a bit of...
It's a different environment now, though, isn't it? It's got new rules in.
And it's a bit of a fallacy. So throughout the 1980s and 1990s, first-time buyers actually put down smaller deposits on average than they did throughout the 2000s and today's first-time buyers. So 1980s and 1990s, the average first-time buyer mortgage loan-to-value, and this is Council of Mortgage Lenders figures, was 94%. Since 2000, it's been 85%. So actually, whilst the suggestion that small deposit mortgages caused the financial crisis gets repeated all the time, and the generation of home buyers, our parents' generation of home buyers, put down smaller deposits. Now, they had the advantage that they were buying at lower multiples of their salaries. Interest rates were higher, which meant their mortgage payments were you know, quite high compared to their income, but they weren't borrowing quite so much debt. But what's interesting actually about the mortgage stats is that it's slightly skewed, obviously, by the post-financial crisis stuff pulling down deposits. But if you just look at the, like, 1982 to 1997 kind of bit, The first-time buyers then were borrowing 95% loan-to-value mortgages. And then if you look at the bit through the 2000s, in the run-up to 2007 and the crash, they were taking 90% mortgages. Even then, they were borrowing less. The problem was what was going on at the margins. It was things like the Northern Rock 125% mortgage, the Together loan, where you took out 100% mortgage and then you borrowed an extra 25% to bundle up some personal loans. I mean, that was a special kind of mortgage madness.
A special kind of mortgage madness. I like the way that's been put.
And 100% mortgages, there are concerns over 100% mortgages. Because there you've got no buffer.
Legitimate concerns.
Zero buffer against house prices falling. And the concern is that people go into them because they're so desperate to get a house and they don't think, hang on a minute, do I need some kind of buffer, safety gap for if house prices fall? And to take in 100% mortgage with a two-year fix, I would say, would be a big mistake. There are a few kind of 100% mortgages around at the moment, but they're different to the ones in the crunch. They require you to have some kind of tie-up to your parents' home or your parent acting as a guarantor or something like that.
Which, whereas, again, be cautious.
In the 2000s, it was just all out. You can just borrow 100% of a property's value.
Yeah. Which is, you know, a lot of what you've been saying about houses, because there's a bit of a running joke over those 4 years of the podcast that I don't like house prices, largely because you get about 800 a week and they're all different. And they're all different for a reason, because they're measuring different areas. And actually, they tell you a part of a story, but they certainly don't tell you the whole story. And it was interesting when you were mentioning earlier about government meddling and interference, is you can't talk about the context of house prices, property booms, etc., unless you talk about this interference, which is exactly where we're going to go now, Simon, because we're going to be talking about it a little bit more. Because you reckon if the government wants to properly shift the market towards homeowners over property investors, the final piece of the jigsaw you say left to put in place is a tax cut for buy-to-let. Now, bear with us on this one, or bear with Simon on this one, because if it happened, it would surely be something of a screeching about turn, given the fact that the only direction that tax on buy-to-letters has been going, Simon, as you rightly point out, is up. So, of course, you've had the extra stamp duty bill, the removal of wear and tear allowance, the hacking back of mortgage interest tax relief. So, if nothing else, this would be rather politically difficult, Simon, but it seems totally counterintuitive, given everything that we've been told, the story, the narrative we've been told about buy-to-let. It's what's putting the block between those first-time buyers getting on the property ladder. Now you're suggesting we make life better for them?
Yes, indeed. Curious idea, isn't it? So look, so as you say, the direction of travel has been one way, more tax for buy-to-let. But why is there more tax for buy-to-let? It's to try and discourage buy-to-let and landlords. It's to say things swung too far in the direction of buy-to-let. We need to make it easier for homeowners than buy-to-let landlords. Whether that's right or wrong, you know, is another matter. That is the stated aim. But it's all very well discouraging buy-to-let landlords from buying with extra stamp duty. It's all very well discouraging them from holding with extra tax on their rental income. But what about encouraging them to sell? Because if you want to discourage buy-to-let landlords and encourage homeowners, then you also need to encourage those existing buy-to-let landlords to sell their properties. So an idea that has been around for some time, and actually there was a rumour that it was going to happen a couple of budgets ago, 2016, I think. Rumour went round, budget day morning, George Osborne was going to cut capital gains tax for buy-to-let. Why was he going to do this? To encourage buy-to-let landlords to sell up? People were like, surely not. I remember thinking that actually, of all the ideas that the government might have come up with, that is quite a sensible idea, because it would encourage people to sell.
So naturally, because they think, didn't come up
if
with
I
it,
sell, yeah, I'll get more money and the government will get less tax. What he actually did was cut capital gains tax for everybody apart from property investors. Yes. So it didn't quite pan out. But this idea was then floated again in this report that came out last week from the Resolution Foundation to do with intergenerational unfairness and this idea of the intergenerational contract being broken. And in amongst a lot of eye-catching things, including £10,000 free for all 25-year-olds, which was the one that grabbed the headlines.
It was, unsurprisingly.
There was bits on almost everything. And one of the bits on almost everything included a bit on buy-to-let. And it said, give landlords selling up a time-limited cut in capital gains tax. The reason why time-limited is because if you just gave them a endless cutting capital gains tax. They just think, well, that's great, because when I sell up, I will...
No impetus to sell.
I'll get more profit, but yeah, you know, there's no rush. Whereas if you limit it for 2 years, people are going to go, right, I need to... I'll get more money if I sell in the next 2 years. And even though actually more properties coming onto the market would probably drive down prices and they wouldn't get more money, people don't think like that. We've seen the opposite happen with temporary stamp duty cuts that drive up the price for the first time buyers buying, yet they still rush to buy and so on. So it would encourage people to sell up. So you cut the capital gains tax. You either cut the rate or you increase the... tax-free allowance that they have, which stands at £11,700 this year. And if you trebled that and limited it for 2 years, it would basically save people just under £7,000 in tax if they were a higher rate taxpayer. And I actually think that this is not a bad idea. I think that this idea potentially works, because it would encourage landlords to sell up. It would be so difficult to sell to the public, because I can see the exact reaction to it. You imagine if Philip Hammond stood up there, delivers a budget in autumn and says, and now I'm giving buy-to-let landlords a tax cut on the hundreds of thousands of pounds of profits that they might have made.
Oh, it'll go down an absolute storm, yeah.
I could certainly see Mr. Corbyn and Mr. McDonnell launching into that one. I can see the Twitter storm already. I can see the Tories helping their capitalist friends. But actually, it fits in with what is going on in terms of trying to discourage buy-to-let. And it would probably work. And the Resolution Foundation suggestion was that they should get it only if they were selling to first-time buyers. I'd go one step further. I'd make it if you were selling to any homeowner. I mean, because if we're not going to let the market correct itself, if we're going to meddle with it, we might as well meddle with it properly. And so this is the final piece of meddling needed to achieve what is the stated aim. That's not to say that I necessarily agree with the stated aim. That's not necessarily to say that the stated aim is a good idea in general. But if you're going to do something, do it properly.
I don't want to get too caught going down this rabbit hole of cross-party sort of bodies that deal with things. But we also had in the Resolution Foundation report, you know, taxing pensioners to cover social care, so sort of an NHS angle, but also housing. Is it time, because of politics, and we are so aware that these sort of decisions, which may actually be rather helpful, and we're getting a lot of interference, which actually is turning out to be not very helpful. Is it better just to take big issues like this away from the government and have sort of independent bodies? Would that work?
Well, I think it might do in a certain way. I mean, I'd like to think that we would be capable of identifying perhaps five very important things that we need to sort, and then saying these have not been sorted under the current political system because it encourages short-term thinking and tribal politics.
Yeah.
So we're going to take these out of the political system. We're going to take some people from here and some people from there. We're going to take the people who have great ideas on the left, the people who have great ideas on the right, and the dramatically unrepresented at the moment people who have great ideas in the middle element. And we're going to put them all together and we're going to see if we can come up with things. And then we're going to put them to the test. We're going to pull together, you know, randomly, like the equivalent of a jury, but maybe a couple of hundred people. And we're going to explain the issues to them, get them to see whether these ideas think they could work. Then we're going to put them to the country as policy. And we're going to take this out of the party political argument. I'd personally like to see that happen. I think we could identify NHS, social care, this problem with housing, what are we going to do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the answer is not just build more homes. It's to do with other things like super low interest rates and stuff like that. Maybe we could even chuck in fixing the roads. But, you know, I mean, would you support that idea?
I think it's a great idea, to be honest. Nothing annoys me more than using these things as political footballs. It's not useful. It's whoever's got the biggest lobby that can shout loudest in the press. Ideas are mooted in the press. I just think the whole thing is a bit of a mess at the moment, and we're so short-termist.
And I don't think it's helped by what you've got.
And I laughed at roads, but infrastructure in the country does need this kind of approach. By the
railways.
Way, for podcast past, not the last podcast but one, Simon gets a little bit ranty about potholes, hence why the reference to roads. So do listen back to that.
But it's not helped at the moment by this element of the sort of political class whose main hobby and actually main endeavour during the working day appears to be shouting at each other on Twitter, which ironically they consider to they look at it like it's this vitally important thing. It's not. It's the most of the rest of the country doesn't have the slightest interest in Twitter. The man on the street is not following the argument about this on Twitter. So you get these elements where, for example,
it's statements like from Amber Rudd when she resigns on Twitter. Yeah. I mean, this is extraordinary.
The Resolution Foundation report came up with a number of these ideas, and whether you agree with the ideas or not, they were ideas. And in it, you know, David Willetts said, well, look, these are some ideas. I don't expect them to all be adopted, but we need to start this conversation. But it would be good to even have a conversation about whether there is even a problem with like intergenerational unfairness. Or maybe this is just an idea that's been cooked up by think tanks and people and the media writing stories about it. Maybe people don't think there is a problem with it. I don't know. But I do know that it, like every other thing, it just degenerated into people shouting at each other on Twitter and this sort of crazy tribalism that there is. That the people, the brightest minds in the country, seem to spend most of their time shouting at each other on Twitter rather than fixing stuff for the rest of the population who haven't got any interest in Twitter whatsoever and whose main use of social media is to share photographs.
Exactly, of cats.
Yeah,
that's what I'm
or their family.
Yeah, but mainly cat videos and dog videos and all that sort of thing. No, it's true. I would love to know your thoughts. Please do get in contact with us about this idea of whether there's an intergenerational issue anyway, because I find that absolutely fascinating. I mean, there was a story in the paper, I think it was today, talking about how Frey Bentos, you know, the pies, the meat pies in a can, have changed because apparently millennials don't know how to open them. I mean, what a ridiculous headline. What a ridiculous concept.
But initially, Frey Bentos' advice was that people should go out and buy a better tin opener, which I thought was quite good advice.
Because
I think there's two things going on here. One, you hardly have to open anything with a tin opener. So I guess there might be a generational issue that millennials are struggling to use tin openers. Two, I think there has been a dramatic decline in the quality of tin openers.
Well, it's a good point, because actually my first thought was it's better for older people or people who've got perhaps arthritis in the hands and can't, you know, get the can openers.
To be honest, I'm a huge fan of the idea that there are all these avocado-munching millennial hipsters out there buying steak and kidney Frey Bentos pies.
Who knew?
Who knew there were enough millennials buying Frey Bentos pies to justify this?
I mean, Frey Bentos, I have not had that since 1972. Right, OK, I just want to ask you before I move on, because talking about millennials, actually, we can't. There was a serious element to which you touched on with that Resolution Foundation report, was the idea, and this is what got the media attention, was that bunging 25-year-olds 10 grand. And they could buy themselves a house, get themselves an education. The first thing I thought was, surely what's going to happen is that the price of house prices are just going to go up 10 grand. Student loans are going to go up 10 grand, or student fees are going to... Really? Really?
Logic tells you that, doesn't it? I mean, the first reaction to it is, if you give every 25-year-old £10,000 to buy a house, then house prices will just go up by £10,000. Now, there is obviously some crucial things to think about here, which is, firstly, they don't necessarily have to spend it on a house. So there would be conditions on this 10 grand. It wasn't just giving them 10 grand in their bank account, knock yourself out.
So kind of a major party.
Interestingly close to the old idea of helicopter money.
Exactly,
isn't
right,
it?
Exactly.
Very interestingly close to it. But they would be restricted so they could use it to buy a house, invest in their education in some way or their career, put into a pension was one idea. One idea that wasn't floated was investing it in an ISA, for example.
Okay, yeah.
So it wouldn't necessarily all go into a house. It wouldn't necessarily all go into a house at the same time. Some people might put some into investing in their career, some into a house and so on. So there's not a direct relationship between this will be £10,000 inflationary onto the cost of houses. So you can't draw that. It would probably add a little bit in there. But of course, the comment then came out. It was like, £10,000? How am I going to buy a house for £10,000? When people start saying, well, the average deposit for a house at the moment, average first-time deposit for a property at the moment is £32,000. And it's much higher in London and the South East, for example. But as we were talking about, you could actually buy a house for £10,000 using it as a deposit. And say, in terms of the difficulty level of passing various tests to buy that house with that 5% deposit, you know, with that £10,000, if you can get over the mortgage element of, like, do you earn enough for someone to lend you the £190,000, then the toughest bit is going to be the saving £10,000, because saving £10,000 is hard.
Yeah, yeah.
Really hard. So it does give you a leg up. I, to be honest, I'm not convinced by the idea.
My only thing, I mean, there are lots of thinkings with this. One, you mentioned the helicopter money, and that is giving everyone, isn't it, regardless of money. And I thought that they had some trials going on in Finland, correct me if I'm wrong, which they've now actually ended. But what I kind of get about these ideas, and it's going back to what we were talking about meddling, is it would be nice just to let the dust settle a bit.
I mean, the obvious problem was that there would be lots of 30-year-olds saying, where's my 10 grand?
Yeah.
35-year-olds, where's my 10 grand? I think this idea of intergenerational unfairness is not just one that's affecting people who are under 25 at the moment. So they're the only people who would benefit. It's one that stretches up to people in their 40s. You know, their early 40s who are looking at the generation above them and going, well, I'm never going to be able to afford the houses that they bought. So it's very difficult to draw the line. And I do think, yeah, what you said there is the problem with all this meddling is that we are not allowing markets to correct themselves or problems to correct themselves. We just keep throwing more stuff, often at the symptoms rather than the cause. So the help to buy element, the super low mortgage rates to deal with the amount of debt that people have taken on. Even the student tuition fees, that's a really interesting one, because actually, if you look at the £9,250 or whatever they are tuition fees, that is clearly a problem. They were introduced. The system that was introduced clearly isn't working. It's clearly a problem. People are unhappy about it and they want it to change. And that's not just students or recent graduates. That's people all through society going, this is wrong. And if you just leave that problem alone, it will fix itself, because the government is going to have to change something and fix this problem. Otherwise, people are just going to get more and more upset and more and more upset. Mm. And eventually it's going to get to the point where the problem is so big, it either the whole thing collapses or something has to be done to fix it. So solving the problem by giving everyone 10 grand, it's like, well, that's not allowing the problem to fix itself. That's just chucking a bit more money at the symptoms.
It just seems hydra-headed. You cut one down and then a load more come up. But anyway, we're going to move on from this, because I do want to ask you, it was a pretty much a dead cert, wasn't it? Interest rates, they were going up in May. Just a few weeks back, we had forecasts of a 90% chance of a rise. And I rather like those rates of 90%. But no, the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee stayed steady at 0.5%. Now, one thing that did go up, though, wages rising faster than inflation for the first time in over a year. So if the pay squeeze is over, why hold?
Well, it's not that over. I mean, we've got some average wage figures coming
some
in
average, yeah.
This week. 2.6% rise in wages, including bonuses, or 2.9% excluding bonuses. There's some debate as to which one of those figures you should use. Inflation, 2.5%. So Britain is getting a pay rise.
Mm-hmm.
It just isn't getting much of a pay rise. Throughout much of modern history, before the financial crisis completely sunk wages, people were getting a decent amount of pay increase above inflation, not a tiny, weeny little amount of pay increase above inflation. So those figures don't look so great. Unemployment looks amazing, though. I mean, we've got record low unemployment, pretty much record high employment.
Mm-hmm.
We've got almost a record low number of people who are economically inactive. So that's just people just taking themselves out of the environment of work. So you could look at that and go, well, yeah, in that kind of scenario, the Bank of England should be raising rates. They're looking, I think, at the consumer economy. They're looking at the struggles on the high street. They're looking at the bad GDP figure for the start of the year, although the mixed messages they managed to deliver on that one were special, even by the Bank of England standards. It was the weather. We're going to look through it. We don't trust them anyway. The numbers anyway, we're going to use our forecast, but because of this low number, I mean, I'm paraphrasing here,
yeah,
but there was a lot of criticism of them for going around in circles, and that all helped with a bit more of the unreliable boyfriend label being chucked at Mr. Carney, who, to be fair, never actually said interest rates were going to go up. It was just markets and economists had decided they were going to go up. We talked about this 3 weeks ago, a month ago, when rates were a dead cert to go up, and at the time, I think I said that I thought they probably wouldn't go up.
You did say that.
I did say that. I said I thought they should go up,
mm-hmm.
and I thought they should seize the opportunity of everybody thinking they would go up to put them up. By the time the rate rise decision came around, though, that morning, everyone had been was completely decided that this dead cert was no longer a dead cert, and they were now a dead cert to be held. So it was no surprise.
Do you think they bottled it, or do you think actually it was a smart move?
They don't.
Obviously,
they don't
want to.
They don't want to be seen to be killing off the recovery. But we've been using that. We've been avoiding killing off the recovery for years now. To 0.75%. If people can't survive at 0.75% rates, then we've got a real problem, and maybe you need to get the creative destruction in and actually let the markets fix the problem. There was a suggestion, though, that from Ben Brettel, who's an economist at Hargreaves Lansdown, that we might now be back in the Goldilocks scenario. Not too hot, not too cold. That means the Bank of England can just stick with 0.5% rates. And he said, maybe we won't even see a rate rise this year. I don't know. What do you reckon, a rate rise this year or not?
Whatever I say always is the opposite. So I'll say yes, there probably will be. But I was a bit distracted by the Goldilocks analogy, trying to remember the actual story of it. Because it didn't work out too well for the Bears. They had she ate their porridge. So not it wasn't good for everyone, you know. She went into their home.
No, that's true, actually, isn't
it?
That's the funny thing about the Goldilocks scenario. Yeah. The Goldilocks scenario is that
there's a chair that's
comfortable that works for her, but she breaks it.
Yeah.
There's some porridge that's just right for her. She steals it and eats it. And there's a bed that's just right for her, and she trespasses and sleeps in it and then runs away.
So take that analogy further. Who's it just right for? Because it wasn't just right for the Bears, was it?
No, I think it might be just right for all the people who've been making stink loads of money off low interest rates for the past however many years, but probably not so all right for all the people who have savings in the bank. It's okay for people with mortgages because it's keeping their monthly payments down. But really, is it okay for homeowners? Because the thing is, most of those homeowners are at some point going to want to move to a more expensive property, or they might be first-time buyers. And all low interest rates are doing is driving up house prices for people. So actually, I don't think it is Goldilocks for the members of the UK. I think you're onto something there.
There you go. Yeah, I don't want someone in my house sleeping in my bed, breaking my chairs and eating my porridge. Honestly. Simon Lambert, thank you so much. You can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, creating millions of reasons to celebrate every month.